Hello and welcome. My name is Jo Frost, and here with my co-host Peter Linus, this is Being Human.
Hey.
How you doing?
I am good, I think. Yeah, I know it's a Friday. It feels good. It's almost the weekend, and I've got to do a big long run. That's what I'm psyching myself up for.
I could not do a run. I mean, I'm never going to do a run anyway, but today is grey. It's cold. The heating is still on. It is ridiculous. I'm over it. And there is nothing that would tempt me to go for a run right now at all.
No, but it's going to be nice tomorrow. The word is it's going to be reasonably good weather. So I'm going running regardless. I have to run. Otherwise, it'll be so painful up that mountain. So that's my reality right now.
Is this us proving our Britishness by opening with talking about the weather?
The weather. Why not the weather? Well, I feel like we're avoiding talking about what we have to talk about. What are we talking about today? What do we have to talk about, Jo?
Okay, so today we are covering the really easy, lighthearted and not controversial topic in any way, shape or form of migration, asylum and refugees.
And there was me thinking we were doing like sexuality or something else instead. So it's this. No. Yeah, this is going to be interesting. It's a big issue. We know that. It's going to be massive in UK elections. It's going to be massive in the US election. It's already been big. It's big in the Indian election coming up right now. As this show will go out, no doubt. And I mean, almost all elections. We talked about it in nationalism in the first show. These protection borders, that it's going to come up.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is going to be our topic of conversation. But before we get too far into that, just a little shout out. Wanted to let you know that Peter and I, we are going to be doing a little mini series of webinars, hopefully a little bit interactive online, chatting about the lens, about some of the personas that we use to help us identify who's in our churches and who we're talking to, and some of the kind of practical top tips about running Being Human and discussing what it means to be human in today's world in your churches and in your context. If you want to find out more about these webinars, where they're going to go, Peter, do you know?
No idea. They're bound to go to our website, beinghumanlens.com, and they should already be subscribed to our mailing list, which you have to go to beinghumanlens.com to get subscribed to.
Well, what a great idea. Yes, subscribe to our mailing list and you'll be the first to know about these sort of things. If not, check us out on beinghumanlens.com or even eauk.org. Either way, you will find out where we're going to be and what's happening. Now, we are using the Being Human lens today to chat about migration, asylum and refugees. As you've already said, Peter, this is a big issue all over the world. Why are we tackling it? How does it impact our conversation about being human in today's space?
Well, we're tackling it because it's a big news story, because of fragile states, because of climate change, because of all that's going on. We've just spent 15 minutes getting ready for this, arguing about how big a problem it is. I mean, that therein lies part of the problem, isn't it? The language around it, the stats on this. So I'm gonna give my best stab at how the scale of the problem, and then you'll tell me why I'm wrong, and then we'll argue about our sources. But between us, we think there's somewhere in the region, let's say, of 1.4 million people migrated into the UK, got a visa, came towards the UK. At the same time, 500,000 people went the other way, out, for whatever reason. So there's a net figure. The weather, and the net figure is 700,000, but that's key. So headline, 1.4 million people coming in, 500,000 going out. Of the 1.4 million coming in, and those figures vary every year and all the caveats, 500,000 of those are students. So they're coming specifically around education. That's fine, right? We've dealt with the 700,000 of those are coming for economic reasons to get a job, because they're family independent, because they've chosen to live here for a variety of reasons. And they are coming through regularized, legal, and we'll come to that term in a minute, visa'd routes. So they've applied for a visa and they've come in. 100,000 ballpark are coming in through unregular, different routes. So they are asylum seekers or refugees, language to be clarified in a moment. And probably about 30,000 within that are coming, again, illegal or irregular routes. And you and I are going to debate why we're using both those terms. But so that big picture again, 1.4, half a million of those are students, 800,000 are coming for economic and family type reasons and a whole host of others. 100,000 are probably the bit that get the headlines. And within that, about 30,000 aren't coming through a recognized route and are applying then for status based on that.
Yes. So I think it's fair to say, at least in the last year or so, the majority of the headlines have been focused around Stop the Boat. It was one of Rishi Sunak's five big pledges. It's on blue billboards all over the place. Rishi Sunak and Number 10 and the government have promised to stop the boat as a kind of response to an apparent social conversation that there is too much migration coming into the UK. And as you're indicating, that's quite an interesting narrative that's being painted, because approximately 30, 40,000 people a year, which is a large number, are coming through illegal or irregular means. Most of those are coming on boats. However, that 30, 40,000 is nothing compared to the amount of students coming, the amount of health and social care workers that are coming, the skilled workers that are coming, and then the dependents that are coming with those people. And that forms the vast majority of people coming in to the UK. And then finally, between the kind of visa economic migrants that we apparently want to come to the UK, the illegal or irregular people that are coming through small boats and other means, we have a kind of middle ground of about 7% of migration that is legal are coming through our safe and legal route to seek asylum in the UK and get their refugee status here. And most of those at the moment are coming from Hong Kong, Ukraine, and then some are coming through the UN asylum settlement process, including Afghanistan. So that's kind of the lay of the land, right?
Yes. And then there's the terminology. So migrants, the big picture. Anybody who changes their country of use or residence for all sorts of reasons, that's a migrant. That's almost like the big umbrella. Asylum seeker is anybody who comes seeking international protection because of fear of persecution on the basis of race, religion, social group, or political opinion. And when you apply, the host government, the UK in this case, because that's where we're based, evaluates your claim and determines if you've met the criteria for refugee status under international law or international conventions governing that. And so that's the route in. Almost everybody's an asylum seeker initially, and then you may or may not be granted refugee status if the home country, UK in this case, decides that it's well-founded, your fear of persecution, of violence, of war, of something happening to you. And so if you meet that criteria, then you're a refugee and you have the right to remain in the UK. Now, there are lots of layers of complication around this incredibly complex area of law. We're not claiming that we are the lawyers in this. We're not claiming those three basic categories. We're very happy. We're comfortable. We've said it gets super complex beneath that, but we're going to try and use those terms. So migrants, big picture, anybody moving, often for economic reason. Asylum seekers, when you're coming fearing persecution and you're applying, you want asylum. And refugee is when you've been granted that status.
So we are not experts. We are not migration lawyers. We do not spend most of our life reading policy papers on the different laws and statuses and practices of migration policy. So why are we talking about this? What is it that we want to contribute into this conversation? Hint, hint, it is the being human lens. Peter, what are we doing here?
I was thinking I'm supposed to ask you that question. I'm sure you're supposed to answer this, but exactly, the lens. Right. We have written the book, The Being Human Lens. And so for me, this is an issue where I probably have less settled views. And actually, I find the lens really helpful in this. Like, great, let's go through the lens and think significance. You matter. How does a person's significance help to frame my understanding of this conversation around immigration? And we use that often generically to cover all these bits. Connection. How does my sense of connection locally and globally impact how I want to think around this issue? The importance of presence and place and where we are. We are an island nation, multiple island nations, as I'm on the smaller island of our islands and all. So what does that mean? What does responsibilities to the place in which we are and responsibilities being a global citizen and to those coming from different parts. What do those look like? And finally, to participate in this conversation is, again, as often in this particular series, these are super contested conversations. And so it's really difficult. And a lot of people don't even fit the sides, but there are definitely sides in this. And articulating a side can get you into all sorts of trouble. And even just trying to start to navigate and articulate a view can get you into trouble without even trying. So we're saying, how do we participate well? That's just the conversation, let alone the hosting, the engaging, the welcoming in. And some will travel to other places and some will be listening and they are migrants to another country. So like we half a million people leave the UK and go to other places and some of them might still be listening. And so they might be on the other end of this conversation. So the lens helps us to begin to frame through those. What does it mean? And what's the better story that we can tell in this conversation? And you should have read the book by now. And if you haven't, go and get the book, by the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's what I love about the lens and why we are talking about it as being a new apologetic, because often in these sort of kind of hot topic conversations, it's about which stat do you use? Which definition do you use? Who do you read? Who's informed? And it just becomes a little bit of a bashing moment of different opinions. Often, at least in my world, I don't always know the validity of what I'm being told or whether or not I should trust a certain voice. So how do we engage in these conversations? And actually, this is a reframing moment. Is there a different way of asking questions and engaging in the space as opposed to feeling like you have to read up on the Illegal Migration Act and the different policy statuses and the different ways of movement around the globe? Or can we actually go, what's our story? How do we enter into this space? How can we speak from a position of knowledge and of confidence into a topic that we may not understand fully? So that's why we want to do it. We're going to start with significant, which is this conversation around you matter, who matters, dignity, equality, and identity. Peter, how does this affect our understanding of migration?
Well, dignity's a really obvious starting point. As I reflected, I was thinking, right, okay, so everybody is an image bearer, everybody's made, you know, that's where our foundation from dignity comes from. Interestingly, it comes out of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and ultimately then into the UN policies on refugees. So those are framed from a very Christian understanding, right from the word go, and the dignity of every single person. But the identity piece comes into play really quickly as well, because, you know, again, we are shaped by the places in which we come from, cultures, national identities. So, so much is in play. Even as we categorize and talk about people coming in, we're saying, well, they're coming from a different place and they're coming to our country and they have a different identity. Our country, their country. Every piece of language around this, and there is really negative language. We've got the kind of swarming invasion language on the one hand, and we've got the kind of welcome, hospitable language. And then there's a lot of fluidity sometimes in the, oh, well, everybody's a refugee and we're all good. And hey, the Bible loves refugees. And we're like, well, yes. Does it also have a place for people and identity and nationhood within that? So I guess straight away you get into a really interesting conversation, I think, around the significance of another person, but what it means to recognize that in the conversation about migration. So for me, it starts the conversation and it gets me really thinking, and it raises probably as many questions as it answers straight away. What about for you?
I think that's really honest, and I think that's really important, that even when we want our starting point to be about dignity and about recognizing the validity of the person, not necessarily even stood in front of you, but the mode in which you interact with that human being, it still gets complicated really quickly. So is it the Bibi Stockholm? Is that the right name for the boat?
Yeah.
Which is this kind of barge off the coast at Portsmouth on the south coast of the UK. And we are currently housing, if you can call it that, some asylum seekers on that barge. And they are basically being locked up. It's a form of imprisonment almost. They can come off, but they have to stay there. They got sent off because they had some kind of awful waterborne disease and everyone was getting sick because it was lacking in sanitary conditions and all of this. And so there seems to be this idea that harshness is a necessary part of how we treat asylum seekers, for fear that if we treat them too humanely, if we're too kind, we will be seen as a soft-hearted nation and therefore attract more people to come through irregular means or illegal route. So in other words, our harshness on an individual is to deter a whole group of people from coming to us. And I can get that argument. I don't like that argument, but I can get it. I do understand what people are trying to navigate. If we're seen as too soft and there's loads of people trying to find somewhere safe to go, does the UK bump up that list? But nevertheless, that is still a human being on a barge that has fairly horrendous conditions on it, because there are so few people advocating for the humanity and the dignity of that person. And they're being basically used as a case study or as an example to others, and diminishing or dehumanizing that person in that moment. And I don't think that's an easy thing to reconcile, but there is something deep within me that finds that very unsettling.
Yeah, I think that's why we find this conversation so difficult. I suppose we want to blend straight away into the better story, because I think one of the things we're wrestling with as Christians is, look, the biblical story is a story largely of migration and of movement. I mean, from Adam and Eve being cast out of the garden, from Joseph going down into Egypt, from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob moving in and out of the land that will be the future promised land in Canaan, to the exiles, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and their different relationships, I would say, with the land, where Jeremiah was put down the roots and Ezekiel, in a way, was a bit more nationalistic in how it was framed. But a lot of the Mosaic law is about how you treat the foreigner and the stranger in your land. And the core underlying narrative, we've talked about this before and we talk about it in the book, is ultimately the people who were brought up out of Egypt. God heard their cries and brought his people out of Egypt. And the constant reminder and refrain is, you were once a people in a land in which you weren't welcome. You were rescued from that land. You were a displaced people in Egypt. And that's a really framing part of Israel's identity, and then part of our story ultimately as Christians, which moves into the New Testament. We are ambassadors, we're people placed in this world where we are not always going to be welcomed. And so how do we understand ourselves within the text is really interesting. So especially if you've been born and raised in this country and you've never been a migrant in a different space, I think it's really interesting to be challenged to think that way. I mean, my own experience was being in Canada, a very different context. You were there as a migrant by choice to go and study. But I've said before in this podcast, I've always felt like, being trained lawyer, I'm in a place where I grew up. I have rights of citizenship here. I understand what my rights are. And I always feel in a conversation or in a situation, I understand my rights and I don't ever feel under particular pressure around them. Canada, I mean, wonderful country as it is, you did know immediately that I was on a student visa and I was at the mercy of anybody revoking that visa if you ever did anything wrong. And it was an interesting moment just to feel a tiny, tiny fraction of what it's like to know that you're not absolutely entitled to be in that place. And you are at the mercy, if you get something wrong, of being kicked out. And I mean, you know, I don't want to make an analogy that's anything like it anyway, but it was a tiny glimmer of what it was like not to feel that sense of right. And so it must be incredibly difficult to understand what it's like to be in that situation, and to try and anchor ourselves in the story. And the biblical story is absolutely one of welcome. Now, we're going to talk about some of the, I think there are, maybe not boundaries, but there are certainly other parts of the story that make us think about exactly what that means. I don't think it's just a carte blanche, hey, we can go wherever we want and just wander the world at will. But it is a challenge to our sense of significance and how deeply rooted it has become in a nation state sometimes.
Yeah, I do think that question of how it feels to travel and how it feels to be in an other space, and how quickly that impacts you and you recognize the fragility of where you are, I think is a really interesting thing. Okay, so that's significance. the question of who matters. And I think it's fairly safe to say that that is not a clear-cut answer. But what it does do is it asks us to consider the innate significance of every person involved in this conversation. Let's re-round. We are now entering into the space of connection, the idea that we matter to each other. And I think for me, there's so many threads that you can pull on the connectivity of migration. One, I suppose, is around the kind of the concept of pulling. Who are we pulling into our space and who are we prepared to pull into our space? Who do we want? And recognizing that actually if we do want certain skills, or we do want certain workforces, or we do want certain kind of academic space coming into our country, who those people are connected to instantly starts to form part of the conversation. So a proportion of the visas that the UK government issue aren't necessarily for the workers that we are seeking. It is for their dependents. It's for their family, because it isn't right to split and separate up a family, husbands, children, elderly parents that need caring for. Actually, if we want one person to come, we have to recognise that they aren't an isolated individual, that they are connected. And that has a massive impact on our understanding of migration.
Yeah, and it's one of the biggest areas that kind of pushed around in law in terms of people, if they commit crimes, being sent back to countries, but then they're saying that underpins or undermines their right to family life here in the UK. And so the family question, I think, gets really complicated really quickly. And I think that the connection thing has so many layers to it again. I mean, there is a flag at the end of the street where our church is that says, I need to get this right. Basically, it's not quite Ulster Says No to More Migrants, but it's pretty close to that. And then charity begins at home. And that's, and we've been trying to negotiate and do more than negotiate to see if we can get it removed, which we can't. And it's probably because our kind of compassion ministries would have quite a number of asylum seekers coming in and out, and it feels somewhat targeted at us. But that aside, the messaging is interesting. The charity, so they're saying, look, essentially local connections are more important than other connections. And one part of me was like, oh, this flag is awful. How do we get it down? But another part of me goes, well, what's motivating and what's driving it? Now, I'd like to ask some questions behind that, and how much does charity actually get at home? What does that look like? But I also want to be careful not to just dismiss it as an argument and say, well, that's just ridiculous, and step away from that, because actually we do have responsibilities to family and extended family. And we are trying to explore how to have that conversation locally, because there are other factors at play, as you might imagine, in Northern Ireland, about how those flags come up and all that they can be. But I'm intrigued. So again, the connection piece is, are we equally connected to everybody in the world? Or am I more connected to my neighbour, to my own family, to the next generation? Because the people who are impacted are those in my community who have less resource and maybe get pushed down the housing list, or the next generation who our decisions now impact as to who's in the country and what resources we have to be able to sustain that. And that connection question actually, I think, is again a little more complex than either side sometimes like to portray it.
Yeah. And I think that next generation piece is absolutely critical, because it is this question of, who are my responsibilities towards? Am I responsible to my family, my community, my nation? Or do I have responsibilities on a more general or global scale? And if I carry that sense of responsibility, at what point does fear start to emerge as a driving force of how we are interacting and connecting with others? So is it a question of hospitality, you are welcome, or is it a fear of, if I welcome you, if you are welcomed into this space, what's that going to cost us and can I meet that cost? So like you say, housing, education, healthcare, employment, welfare, taxes, all of those things start to bubble up as issues of concern, also recognized as issues of fear. They're the what if questions. What if this cut happens and we can't cope? And so for me, I find it really interesting that that connectivity is often based on a kind of forward thinking. If we go too far down this route, we're stuck, we can't backtrack, we've got to be cautious. And therefore, what does that do to the sense of obligation, of charity, of hospitality, of seeking the welfare, of being on the side of the vulnerable quartet that the Bible talks about? Where does that connectivity and responsibility sit within this conversation?
Yeah, and there's a theologian and ethicist, Oliver O'Donovan, and he says it's essential to our humanity that there should be always foreigners, human beings from another community who have an alternative way of organizing the task and the privilege of being human so that our imaginations are refreshed and our sense of cultural possibilities renewed. And for me, that picks up your fear point, saying like we're so often driven by fear. The other side of this is actually it's what's possible and our imaginations being refreshed, and we thrive off that kind of intercultural engagement. And so there's incredible benefits to that diversity. Like, listen, we're an intercultural country, you know, at the very least we are four nations in one, but within that we're like going back, we're all sorts of tribes and a mixed match of people coming together. But I'm still intrigued. There's an article we'll link to by a guy called Luke Bretherton about borders, because implicit in this conversation essentially is there a role for borders and how do we protect them or not have them? And almost there's an open border kind of, hey, everybody's free to move as they want. And I think the risk there is the kind of idol of individualism that we just, it's all about me and I can go wherever I want. And there should be some freedom of movement, I think. But there is a kind of almost global, especially from those who travel loads, who are like, hey, everybody can come and go what they like because they've traveled almost unimpeded and think everybody should have that benefit. And like many of us are in that camp where we've traveled largely unimpeded. So there's very open border. And then there's a kind of probably a more controlled, more communitarian response. So one's a kind of libertarian and one's a communitarian. The borders are necessary because if you want to sustain community life, at some point you have to have some sort of boundaries, be it a family, be it a club, be it a community, be it a church. You still have some sort of sense, well, actually, we have something that keeps us together. There's something that sustains our common life. But the dark side is the idol of the state, the British values in this, you know, for us in the UK, or some sort of historical idea. 20 years ago, it was all wonderful. If only we could go back. And there's idols on both sides of that conversation. But for me, I think there is a place for borders. It's just at what level we assert those. And you know, we were in Switzerland recently and driving, you drive between Switzerland and France and Germany and you just drive through. But they're still there. There's still a moment where they can say, hold on, we need to check what goods you're moving. You can move with incredible freedom. So it's just trying to understand the purpose of borders and what the role of the nation and the community and the extended family is in this conversation.
Yeah. I wonder if it's going back to the word you used a couple of episodes ago, porous. What does it mean to have porous borders? I was reading an article rather than listening to the album about Beyoncé's new album, Cowboy Carter. And part of it is this sort of idea of her coming from Texas and instead of being a pop or an R&B artist, why couldn't she be a country and western artist? And there was this whole idea that she had been rejected by Nashville, that the kind of the country music scene had a hint of kind of white elitist. And the article was pointing out that actually she was pulling on so many other genres of music that the album was hinting at the idea of just how impoverished the country music scene had become, because it wasn't pulling from gospel, it wasn't pulling from R&B, it wasn't pulling from dance, and therefore because it had been such an isolated culture, it hadn't had the opportunity for the creativity, the innovation and the fresh and the new to come in. And I just think that's actually a conversation that we don't hear a lot about, which is actually what happens if we do get too isolated, if our connections are driven more by fear than of welcome, what does that actually ultimately cost us? And are we paying those kind of conversations enough heed? What does it cost us to be closed?
Yes. I think, well, look, we're kind of moving here to presence anyway, because it's the reality. And to go back to the borders, my analogy in that is similar, like in terms of what does it cost us? But I have a diary on my phone, and my diary does control or lots of my life. I look each day and go, what am I supposed to be doing? That enables me, that has a lot of, does a lot of framing and structuring of relationships for me. So I could have no diary and I'd have great relationships with a certain amount of people for in the immediacy, just even thinking in work life. Well, there's half a dozen people I'd immediately connect with because I enjoy them. There's another half a dozen people I might not immediately connect with in the same way. And if I'm not careful, my world can become chaotic and shrink. So there is something in the diaries and the structure that also helps manage my relationships, that I need to take family time out. We can only get family holidays if we get them in the diary early. And I know you and I have talked about this before. The diary isn't always bad. Some people go, oh, you're ruled by your diary. I'm like, well, I am. I'm going on holiday for 2 weeks because I'm ruled by my diary that got that in. So, and to me, that's a little bit like borders. Again, analogies aren't perfect. There are times when they offer a certain amount of protection and openness. It's how we do the two things together. And I think that's just part of the challenge, because we are particular people from a particular place. If you think, you know, it's not possible for me to love all of humanity just sitting here in Portugal and go, hey, I love everybody wonderfully.
You could, Peter. If you tried really hard, you could love everybody.
I can say it, and I do, but on a meaningful level, it doesn't, that statement doesn't, to me, make a lot of sense. The reality of what that looks like is how that gets worked out is particular people in a particular place, and not just on my doorstep. Friends all over the world. We were chatting with a number of friends from Canada, well, who I knew in Canada, and who are based in different parts of the world now last night. So it's not, I'm not saying that limits us, but the reality is I can only love a particular number of people. I can only care for, I can only meaningfully relate to. And so the reality is we are present in a time and place. I mean, they talk about the kind of scandal of particularity in the gospel as well. Jesus had to turn up in a particular place, and therefore he had to look like a Palestinian man. Like that was inevitable. And he had to act like it and dress like it and speak in Aramaic, because we are particular people from particular places. And I think that gets, again, back to the challenge of, I love going to different cultures, but I don't go to India and say, hey, guys, where can I get my beef? I remember a friend once doing an illustration. He talked about a beef burger. Like, just because you go to McDonald's doesn't turn you into a hamburger. And the translator was looking at him and he just didn't realize. So you can't, cows are sacred in India. You don't get beef burgers in India. You know, I can't go to that place and put my demands on, nor can you use a sermon illustration, as my friend discovered, talking about beef burgers, and then wonder why nobody understood what you were trying to say. Because I need to respect the culture in that place, and I need to respect what's going on in that culture. So I'm trying to wrestle again with what it means for each of us to be from places. Some of us are more mobile and have traveled to lots of different places and had a wonderful diversity of culture, but we take bits of us and gather things from those culture. And there is something particular about the places that we're in and how we respect those and how they shape and form us.
Yeah. I think that when it gets to the presence piece of being here now matters. And what does it mean to be in a particular time, in a particular place, and in a particular body? How does that affect our understanding of migration? I think that kind of intercultural conversation and that integration conversation is absolutely critical, because that's what migration does. It changes a theoretical conversation about who's welcome, where do they come from, to an immediate conversation of they're now my neighbors, they're now in my schools, my kids are now going to school. It becomes a present here and now issue. And I think culture is a massive part of that, because it is both incredibly intangible about what a culture is, what it stands for, the idea that we should be promoting British values to people coming into the UK, but nobody can agree what a British value is. always fascinates me. And yet we all know intuitively as Brits what that looks like. My family and I, we lived abroad for a year. We were in France. On so many levels, there was lots of similarity. The language barrier was definitely a barrier, but by and large, we were welcome and we were fine. But there were so many culturally othering moments, and you can't really describe them. But what happened to us when we came back and we put our kids into French school to try and keep some of the French alive? And so on a Saturday morning, you are stood in a hall waiting to collect your kids, as you would any other club, right? But even in that hall, with nobody speaking to me, nobody doing anything other than waiting for the kids, it was as if I had walked into France. And I can't tell you why. I can't tell you what they were doing that was different. They weren't dressed different. There wasn't any behaviours. There wasn't anything strange. It was just culturally, all of a sudden, I knew instinctively that there was a different kind of value set going on. And I think that's the moment where we are confronted with the issue of presence and our humanity, that the here-ness and the now-ness of what we are used to and what we are familiar with changes. And how do we respond to that? What do we do with that? How do we help people navigate that? That intercultural conversation around migrancy is costly, because it requires all of us to pay more attention to what we're used to and what we think is important or significant, and bend in a way that we may not necessarily be comfortable with.
Yeah, and I think that bending is really impacted by the presence of, be it asylum seekers or refugees or migrants, in our worlds, in our churches, in our towns, in our communities. So we can have an abstract conversation about some ideas. And we were talking to somebody recently who'd come in, and as they told their story, there were bits I was like, I'm not sure I entirely agree or understand the decision that's allowed you to be here, but I really like you and we're having a great conversation. And so I was like, this is intriguing, because the presence of the person right with me and the connection and relationship with the person was shaping my particular read on my understanding of the law in that particular situation. And so that's the other part of presence. We want to absolutely be particular to the person who's right there in front of us. And that, I think that takes us to participation, because part of this is we've gone an abstract, or at least a higher level of participation, voting and policy and the framing, and we've got very hands-on, because the church is one of the leading groups participating in this conversation. I mean, we know, almost certainly most people picked up a story a few months ago about the guy who, the acid attack in London, and then this whole thing about the minister who had affirmed him staying. And there's lots of controversy about that one particular story, but the reality is lots of people have stayed here because lots of churches and lots of ministers have been involved in the conversation, and lots rightly so, because they came from persecution and they came from countries where they could not return to, and their engagement with the church and the Christian faith, either a pre-existing commitment and they came here because they were persecuted Christians, or people who found faith here, has been entirely legitimate and the church has been at the front end of receiving them in. So one aspect of our participation is the incredible way in which the church has served in this moment. And it's taken some critique, and sometimes you say, do you know what, it's not our job to decide that asylum application. It is our job to welcome the person in and help support them in the situation.
Yeah, yeah. And say honestly and faithfully who they are and who you've encountered. And you can't be expected to do more than that, but you shouldn't be fearful of doing that in the first place. I think for me, participation, the difference that we make in the world matters, is around, I suppose, the reluctance that I see for people to participate in these conversations and recognize the nuance and the complexity of it. I think, at least in the world I inhabit, I see a simplicity around some of these conversations, that we can reduce them into sound bites, or we can just say, oh, we want to reduce migration, or we want to stop the boats, or we want to welcome everybody, or whatever it is, whichever aspect or side that you're coming from in this conversation. And yet, even just the last 45 minutes of us wrestling around this, there aren't any easy answers. There aren't any quick wins. In fact, if anything, this is going to get more costly and more complicated. We've got an upcoming episode talking about climate change and the impact that that will have on us individually and as a global society. And I have been acutely aware for years as to how significant the political conversations our children are going to have on immigration and migrancy as climate change worsens, as states getting more and more fragile, as the pressure of climate change and violence and reducing resources starts to emerge, and just how many people are going to be on the move in the next 20, 30 years. And so the sound bites, the quick solutions, the vote winners, the opinion polls, all of those things are doing us, and especially our children, such a disservice, because we are not giving anybody an opportunity to put in the political framework, the education, or the understanding that will allow our kids to start to navigate some of the impossible decisions that they are going to be asked to be made on who can come and how we can facilitate keeping people alive from around the globe.
Yeah, and I think that nuance in the conversation for us as Christians is incredibly important, because I do see that kind of fairly simplistic, you know, we're entitled to hold our borders kind of chat from some people. It's almost like protect the Christian culture of our country to the Jesus was a refugee and therefore everybody's welcome. And you're like, there's a lot more nuance. I mean, you look at the Old Testament, you've got two main terms, the stranger, the ger in the Hebrew, to be treated as equal. They were told, the Israelite people were told, treat them as an equal, love them as yourselves. But those strangers were long-term strangers who had to observe Sabbath. Like, they had to observe the cultures and customs of Israel. So there's a kind of quid pro quo there. But then there's another term, the Nokri, the foreigner, who could not eat Passover. And they were treated differently. And when it came to debt repayment, there were actually different rules for Israelites versus some of the foreigners. And so the text does both inclusion and distinction. We are to be aliens and strangers in the New Testament. You know, we're not to assimilate into the culture around us. Jesus was a refugee, but it was child genocide that led him to go away, and he returned to his own country. Each of these stories has another layer that's at least worth exploring. And so I think we need to be really careful of those fairly simplified positions on all sides of the Christian accounts. Actually, it is complex, and we are dealing with an increasingly complex world where movement is much easier. Climate change, as you've said, is going to necessitate or drive significantly more levels we have not even thought about. And yet, the God story absolutely framed on a core narrative of what it is to be a people displaced from their land and then called by God to be a light to the nations around. So right at the heart of our story, the story that I, as I understand it, we've been engrafted into, is one of what it is to be a displaced people. And that's our constant theme, to be ambassadors. But I think ambassadors is even different than the refugee idea, isn't it? Like, there's a calling in that, and there's a holding in that, and an understanding of what it is to be sons and daughters of the King in that moment, living into a different way of being, what it is to be human in this moment. And so right at the heart of this is it's tough, but we want to reframe the conversation and engage differently in this very difficult, very often toxic, but incredibly important conversation about immigration, about asylum seekers, about refugees. Yeah. And about nations and borders, all of that and what it entails.
And if we do anything, let's keep coming back to the start. Because you can get lost in the weeds, I think, so easily, in the nuance, in the complexity, in the yes, but what about? If we just keep coming back and saying, every human being is made in the image of God and bears his likeness and his character. So am I treating this person and these people as if they are carrying the likeness and the character of the God who I serve? And if the answer is no, then we need to pull back and we need to go, okay, so what does that look like? And if the answer is yes, okay, let's keep going. But if we're losing sight of that single foundational truth, then that's probably where we're going to go wrong quite quickly. So, takeaways, Peter. What would we do? It's not just a story, it's a practice. How do we inhabit this better story?
Yeah, the main one for me is gratitude. I think in the same way that Israel reminded of their story again and again and their rescue out of slavery, I think we've just been chatting to kids about this again recently, like grace and thankfulness and the things that we have. Because as we recognize the incredible privileges and benefits that we have, you suddenly begin to see, well, look who doesn't have them and what would that look like? And so I think our own gratitude for so much of what we have just reframes our engagement in the conversation. And the slight fallout for me is probably study again, just that sense of this is complex. The Bible has actually lots to say, but it's an issue we need to understand locally. And by locally, I don't just mean UK. Like, it's different in Northern Ireland than it is for you guys in London. It's different in the place that I live than it is in Belfast in Northern Ireland. You know, so I need to understand the Eritrean folks and the Iranian and Afghans who are the main people coming into our area, and they're in our primary school, and that's great. And so my wife's really engaged in it. So we need to understand their cultures and where the potential connects and disconnects might be. So studying actually is really important if we're going to welcome people well.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Obviously, I'm going to say hospitality.
No way. Shock. Every week. It's like bingo, right? It's 4 weeks in a row. Come on.
I don't think it's ever going to not feature. What does it mean to be both a host in this space, but actually, as people come in, are we prepared to be guests into their world and into their culture? Do we enter into the homes of people who are moving into a space? Do we let our kids play next to them? Like, how are we carrying the holiness of God into these spaces and into these conversations? Hospitality is key. But I do love that point about just study, digging deep into the God story and what does God have to say about people from other spaces, because the God story is full and is rich. And I do think both how God speaks about people who are displaced, how we are encouraged to engage with people who are displaced, but also probably even more than that is the God story is a story of abundance. And in our world, we have a massive conversation about scarcity, about how little we have and how little resource there is and how small the pie is. And yet we are immersed in a story of the lavishness of God. And I think it's really easy to lose sight of the God of abundance and lose sight of that story when in a world we are scared about how little we have and what we could lose. So I suppose that's my invitation to us all, is to spend some more time with a lavish and abundant God and see what he can say about this space. Until next time, take care. God bless. We'll catch you soon. Thank you.